I'm going to speak about one of the older texts in the Pali Canon. So allegedly, we led to believe these are the words of the Buddha. These are the teachings directly coming from the Buddha, written down at some point in Pali. And I'll start by actually reading out the sutta that I'm going to talk about. And this sutta is called the Vipalasa Sutta. And the translation of that is distortions of the mind. And this is a translation by Andrew Olensky. So if you want to find a lot of very good translations from original Buddhist texts, there is a website called Access to Insight. It's got a huge amount of very good translations. There's alternative translations to this sutra as well, but I've chosen this because I find it's most simple. I like the language best of this one. So I'll read it out, okay? So the Vipalasa Sutta. These four, O monks, that's you for this evening, are distortions of perception, distortions of thought, distortions of view, sensing no change in the changing, sensing pleasure in suffering, assuming self where there is no self, sensing the unlovely as lovely, gone astray with wrong views, beings misperceive with distorted minds, bound in the bondage of Mara, those people are far from safety. They're beings that go on flowing, going again from death to birth. But when in the world of darkness Buddhas arise to make things bright, they present this profound teaching which brings suffering to an end. When those with wisdom have heard this, they recuperate their right mind. They see change in what is changing, suffering when they're suffering, non-self in what is without self. They see the unlovely as such. By this acceptance of right view, they overcome all suffering. So that is the text that we're looking into tonight. And not sure whether I'll be able to elucidate everything in this text, but I will certainly be going into a few of those aspects. So, what have we got here? I'll just look at my notes. So, just to say, this isn't a very well-known teaching, so it's not sort of... I haven't actually found a huge amount of commentaries to it, but I do think it's a... I find it a really interesting set of teachings, and I think it can be a really powerful tool. So I think we probably all, as we're sitting here tonight, know about the three poisons in Buddhism. I think a lot of you might know about what the basic poisons are. So the Buddha says that there's three habitual destructive states of mind that lead us to suffering, and we kind of drag other people along in it, and it's greed, it's hatred, and it's delusion or ignorance. So I think some of you might have heard about those. The thing with greed and hatred, they're fairly easy to find in your experience. You know, you can feel what that is like, greed. You can feel, I think, what hatred or anger is like. But I think the ignorance one is the most difficult to grasp, and I think I often don't quite know what it is referred to, and how do you actually know what is ignorance? How do you recognize ignorance in your experience? Because ignorance, we're told, ignorance is at the root of those two other poisons. So both hatred and greed both stem from that root delusion, poison of ignorance. So that is what we learn, and this is through all the suttas. This is like one of the core teachings of the Buddha. So the Buddha identifies these as binding us to the wheel of samsara, and we're habitually acting in ways that cause suffering to ourselves and others. And we're mainly talking about suffering as emotional pain, as it were. So that's the kind of suffering that is talked about here. And I think it's important to realize that these teachings that the Buddha, all of these teachings that the Buddha has passed on, are addressing this problem of suffering. So they're not addressing anything that isn't a problem, as it were. They're really there to help addressing this problem of suffering, of alleviating emotional pain. So I often think, like, why would we even apply them to things that are not a problem? We are trying to apply them to the things that are problematic. So that's where they work. That's what they're meant to do. And so another word for this root cause of suffering, that is ignorance, is avidya. And these vipalasas that I just talked about, that we just read out in the sutta, they're like a description of how ignorance operates in the psyche, as it were. How ignorance operates, on what kind of levels ignorance shows up in our experience. So the idea is that, so this is what the Buddha says, we don't see reality as it is, but we're distorting it some sort of way. And because we're distorting it in some sort of way, we're causing ourselves suffering and causing other people suffering. So there is a particular distortion going on, and you could say that is ignorance. And this sutta describes how that works, the mechanics of that. So, how do we recognize ignorance in our experience? Ignorance is about what's been blocked, what's being denied, what's not being seen. It's like what's not been understood. It's doubt. I can often find it really uncomfortable, this sense of like something is wrong, but I don't know exactly what it is. So I think that is the kind of area that we'll be looking into. And it is, in this respect, very important to at least take that assumption, or what the Buddha teaches us on board. He is actually saying that, yes, there is a distortion going on. There is some sort of delusion going on. So that needs to be taken on board somehow. And I'd just like to give you a minute to see if you agree with that in your own experience. Just look in your own experience and see if you can find some sort of agreement with that there. We'll just give you a minute or two. So just let's, for the sake of the argument, take on board that the Buddha is right in this, and that there is some distortion going on in how we perceive reality. And I just wanted to say that this is not about being bad, or it's not about not being good enough. It's more that looking into this area, there is an opportunity to wake up a bit more and to free ourselves a bit more from this suffering. And waking up from delusion isn't easy, and I think that's why it's really important I asked to do the metta bhavana beforehand, to just do this kind of looking in your experience. Do that with a lot of patience, a lot of love, and a lot of kindness, and a lot of compassion. It's not about not being good enough. It's not about not doing it right. It's more like taking the positive. It's like there is this opportunity that might help to alleviate suffering. So a sure sign of ignorance being at work in your life or in your experience is that there is some sort of suffering happening, if you see what I mean. So if some sort of suffering is happening, it's a sure sign of there is some sort of ignorance at work. So I think that's nice to turn that on its head. So I was just thinking about an example of my own life where I felt there was some sort of mysterious kind of ignorant thing going on in my life. And this is quite a simple example, but I failed a few times in Amsterdam for my driving exam, and at one of those occasions we were approaching a roundabout, and I had this sense like, oh, we've done a roundabout already today, you know. Got this sense there's something here. I don't quite know what it is. So I'm doing the roundabout again, and I'm doing it wrong again, and failing my exam. They're very, very strict in Amsterdam, I can tell you that. But so something about that sense of there is something not quite right, but you can't put your finger on it. I relate that to what ignorance may feel like in our experience, if that makes sense at all. Mm. Yeah, see a few nods, that's always good. So this idea about ignorance is that it just seems like maybe an image could be like an iceberg, for instance. You know, you see a tip of the iceberg, but there's like a lot underground. So that's another image, I think, for ignorance. There's just a lot of it sort of happening that you just can't get access to. You just can't see it. It's operating, but it's like operating under the surface of our consciousness, as it were. And I actually think that I get quite excited by all of this, because it is a bit like going into unknown territory and starting to discover, you know, like it's a bit like being one of those expeditions, you know, we're going to go into this territory and find out what's happening there. You just don't know about what's happening there. So I find it quite exciting, and also something about becoming more aware of what your blind spots are, because how are you going to know? How are you going to learn what your blind spots are? So that's why I'm quite excited about these teachings, because there's ways of pointing at the blind spots that I think is going to be really hard to find if you're not using some sort of method to scrutinize your experience. And so another thing that I'd been thinking about, I think some of you might have seen this film, The Matrix. I know it's quite ancient by now, but, you know, it's like mid-90s film, isn't it? The Matrix. Somebody must have seen The Matrix.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, The Matrix. Yeah, anyway, you know this, The Matrix. There is that opportunity, there's these pills, I can't remember which colour they are, but you get this, there is this opportunity in the film that's offered, if you take this pill you're going to wake up to reality, if you take this pill you're going to just roll on and just you know, go roundabout in a sort of very comfortable world. And it's very comfortable, you get really lovely food, it's like tasting really nice. And, you know, you watch telly all day, you know, binge-watching, whatever you're Breaking Bad or something, you know, or whatever the current popular series are. So, you know, you're like binge-watching, you're like drinking wine, you're like eating all day, and you're having this wonderful time. I don't think so, but anyways, when you're not really plugged into reality, not really plugged into what's really happening in the body. And actually, in The Matrix, what you see is all these people are they're kind of plugged into this sort of pod. They're not, you know, their bodies are just like empty shells, and it's all like virtual. It's all happening in their minds. So to wake up from that is incredibly difficult, but it's incredibly rewarding. So waking up from ignorance isn't easy. It's not easy, but is incredibly rewarding. And you can feel a bit like Neo, you know, if you start this exploration. I do. Totally like Neo. So this commitment to the truth, to uncover what is beneath the surface, and to understand the mechanisms that create suffering, is quite exciting, in my view. So what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about the vipalasa. So I know I'm introducing a new word here. Obviously, this word has been new to me too, but I know that I've learned to pronounce it. So it's vipalasa with double L. And the Sanskrit version, this is Upali, is viparyasa. Some people might have heard of those. In Triratna, we have sometimes heard from the viparyasas as the topsy-turvy views. But we're talking about the Pali, so the Pali canon, the original teachings of the Buddha are written down in Pali, so that's the language we're referring to here, Pali. So as a word, vipalasa, it's, I've looked up several definitions, and I'll just mention a few of the translations I found. A translation for vipalasa could be hallucination or distortion, a perversion or a delusion, a misperception, a fantasy, an exaggeration or a misrepresentation, a contortion, an erroneous observation, or if you just want to make a sentence out of it, it's the taking that which is true as being false and that which is false as true. So it's you get the idea. So that's it. We're talking about distortion here. And the word vipalasa, I'm told, it literally means overthrown. So it's like on its head. It's upside down. Mm-hmm. And I think the word comes from, like, you've got cart, and it's a cart, it's like on its back, and it's like the wheels are sticking in the air. So it's on its head. And I was also thinking about beetles today. You know, have you seen those? With these legs sort of like, yeah, and they just, you know, they can't get up, can they? You just feel like, oh my God, they're just so stupid. They don't know how to get up. But so it's a bit like
sheep
that.
As well, can sheep? Yeah, they get stuck on their backs.
Oh, no. Yeah. Have you ever saved a sheep?
I have indeed.
Yeah. Very good. Excellent. So that's you've
my merit.
But you've earned your merits. Very good. So it's a vipalasa means overthrown, turned, or put on its head. And in the some of you might be familiar with the three characteristics of existence. Some of you may be familiar with that. It's one of the three characteristics. You also find it throughout the teachings in Buddhism. It's this. It's the Buddhist teachings about phenomena experience, that everything is impermanent. Everything is ultimately insubstantial, unsatisfactory. So that's the three marks of existence. I've got to unpack all of that. I'll try to do that. It's quite a lot of information. I'm hoping to that you won't get overwhelmed. So of this list of these, the four distortions of mind that are mentioned in this sutta, the three of them correspond to these characteristics of existence. It's denying those characteristics of existence. So it's seeing that what is factually, actually, if you look deeply into it, impermanent, seeing that as permanent. So that is our first distortion. And the second distortion is seeing that what is ultimately unsatisfactory as satisfactory. And the third one is seeing that what doesn't have any kind of substance as solid and substantial. And then, so that is corresponding to these three characteristics. And then our list of four that's added to this is seeing that which is unlovely as lovely, seeing what is actually not beautiful as beautiful. And I'm using the word seeing here. You're perceiving, you could perceive something, for instance, that's factually impermanent as permanent. But it is also in an emotional quality, like you're looking for, you're longing for something to be permanent, for instance, whereas it actually is impermanent, and that is causing suffering, because you're not going to find anything permanent there, because it is actually impermanent, but you're hoping that it is permanent, for instance. So that is one of those examples of how these distortions work. So I'll just see how I'm doing in terms of my timing. Well, I don't know, I'll just continue. Not bother too much about that. So I'll just go back to the first one again. So this is this tendency to see what is actually impermanent as permanent. And so you're seeing, or you're trying to find a solidity or stability in and permanence in what isn't. Yeah. And so an example of this could be that something is always the same every day, and then one day you come and it's not there anymore, or it's broken, or it's different. It's that it's just incredible. I find it a lot of Buddhists I know, including myself, change isn't easy often, but it's that if you find change difficult, it means that there must be an underlying assumption that there is something that is not changing there, if you see what I mean. So there's the expectation of something remaining the same day after day, and one day, okay, it's gone, and you're incredibly disappointed, which, you know, that's understandable that you'll be disappointed, but it does mean that you haven't really seen that that thing was never permanent in the first place, whatever it is. It might be, you know, it might be a friendship, or it might be a person who goes away, a job that goes away, a car that's declared that doesn't pass the MOT or whatever. You see what I mean? It's those kind of hopes and expectations that we're relying on. Things we're relying on these things to be permanent, and that's we are kind of getting a sense of security from that. But in reality, this is not the case. There's nothing that can be found anywhere that is permanent, and that even, you know, something that seems to be quite long lasting, like a mountain, is still changing in minimum kind of ways. And if you look at it from a larger time perspective, at some point that'll go as well. You see what I mean? So there's nothing to be found that can't change, that doesn't change, but that's permanent. Okay? So that's the permanence one. And the second one is about it's actually trying to find happiness or pleasure in something that ultimately cannot give that contentment. So it's also said you're trying to find sukha. That's the Pali word for pleasure or happiness in what is actually dukkha, unsatisfactory. So there is that search of happiness that is based on in illusions rather than on reality. So, for instance, what you're trying to find, I mean, this is like your maybe a well-known example for most of us, I'm sure, actually, for all of us, to be honest, unless you're there's an enlightened being in our midst, which is perfectly possible. Yeah, it is. So, for instance, you're feeling some sort of feeling of unhappiness or discomfort, and you're going to the biscuit tin because you feel like if I have a biscuit, that's going to make me feel good, it's going to make me feel happy. You're eating the biscuit, and obviously it's not going to give that. There is no happiness to be found in eating that biscuit, because the happiness is to be found in actually staying with the discomfort. But that is often just too difficult, isn't it? It's just so difficult to stay with discomfort that you're trying to find ways to kind of not deal with it somehow. So you're reaching for that, the sweets or the chocolate or the binge watching on Netflix or something, yeah, to find that satisfaction. But actually, it's not there. It's not there. I mean, everybody, you know, I'm sure it's completely understandable that we're doing it, but ultimately we cannot find it in that. You see what I mean? Because it's just not there, I'm afraid. But yet, we try. Yeah. And then another one, which is the one about seeing substantiality where there isn't any. Is about seeking, or you're just actually trying to find something that is like, like a neat package, like you can control it. So in a sense of, so you're starting to try to create something that you think that this is mine, and you're calling it mine. This is mine. This is my body. This is my meditation practice. This is my my love. This is my merit. You see what I mean? You're trying to create packaging something that isn't actually a neat kind of package. It isn't actually anything that has a beginning or an end. So you're trying to find this illusion of stability, something, this is me, this is mine, this is you, this is that, this is neat, this is tidy, this is all sussed. So you're trying to find this, you're creating an illusion of something that is stable, something that is predictable, something that is safe, that is under control. And and things are just not like that. They're just not like that. They don't have a beginning. They don't have an end. They're not dependent on a me or a mine or an I. They're not mine. They're not mine. I don't know how clear this is, but anyway, I'm trying. So this is this trying to. To create a world that is solid and stable, whereas things, they're just not like that. So lastly, we have Shubha, which is you're trying to find something. You're trying to pursue or the beautiful, because you're thinking that is going to give you satisfaction, that is going to give you happiness. And again, there is nothing really to be found that is intrinsically beautiful. Like, you could have something that's incredibly beautiful, but you know, like, you could just join up with a person who's like this really beautiful person, but then when they're angry they look really ugly. Mm-hmm. Or when they've had a cold they've got this red nose and they're not so beautiful anymore. Or you're trying to make things slightly more beautiful in order to give yourself a good feeling about things, to kind of gloss over reality, because reality could be a bit too naked and a bit too ugly to be with. So you're trying to make it a bit more beautiful so you get a better feeling. So that is the kind of mechanism of this distortion of trying to find the beautiful in what isn't actually beautiful. I've actually never, I had never worked with this particular one before, so because it was new to me, because of these teachings were new to me. I knew about the three characteristics, but this thing about this, the thing about this embellishing or beautifying or sprucing up of your experience, I thought was quite interesting. So when I was looking at it in my experience, I just found that it did explain something to me that I had not seen before. There's kind of this tendency to make something slightly more attractive than it actually is. So it's a bit more palatable, it's a bit easier to be with. I don't know whether you recognize that in your experience. So that is also one of those distortions. I was actually, in this respect, thinking about the emperor's clothes. You know, you've got these... Well, you know the story about the emperor's clothes. This emperor who's got... Oh, God, it's such a long story. I'm not sure whether I'm going to go into it. It just comes down to that this whole idea of embellishment and beauty is also an illusion. And underneath, there's just somebody, you know, naked without the beautiful clothes on. And that is like the truth. But the truth can be quite difficult to stomach, if you see what I mean. And sometimes then... we need to kind of put a nice veneer over it, and it becomes a bit more easy to deal with. So that is that distortion of finding the beautiful in what isn't really beautiful. And one memory that came up in me was that this is whilst I just graduated from university, and I was taking a holiday with a group of friends, and a friend of mine, he's like, really likes to make photos. And he was making this, he was just making photos of nature. And I was just completely intrigued, because what he started doing is like he was lifting up stone and kind of sort of pushing it a bit more this direction. And he was like just sort of trying to rearrange the leaves. And I thought, what is he doing? I just really didn't get it. He wanted to make it more beautiful. But I actually thought, like, how can it be more beautiful than how it is now? How you know, in some sort of way, nature will create such an amazing beauty that doesn't need to be kind of tweaked or added on. But sometimes nature is also incredibly, could be harsh as well, can't it? There is something, you know, you see like a skeleton or half-picked skeleton of some sort of bird, or and then it's like, ouch, you know, it's just, there is, it's reality in that sense. That is reality. Nature is not just, you know, the beautiful sunset and the beautiful flower. It's much more complicated than that. And that's, I think, is a good example or a good metaphor maybe for reality. And you could say we have that in our own experience as well. You know, a lot of the time, or sometimes there's these beautiful flowers and there's nice branches. But sometimes, you know, we meet the horrible skeleton or the whatever. I can't really think of more horrible nature images. Most of them are fairly beautiful, aren't they? But just something like the rawness of experience that could be difficult to be with. So yes, you need a lot of courage and kindness and compassion to look at this. So these are these four distortions, the four vipalasas. And the next thing I'm going to go into is that they're operating on different levels. So you remember I talked about this iceberg and everything that was kind of going on under the surface that you can't see. So if you think about a building, like for instance, maybe this is a good building. We're now on the what we call lower ground floor, which is another word for basement. Beautiful word for it, but we call it lower ground floor. Yeah, so we have the ground floor, we got the lower ground floor, and under here, some people might not know it, is a parking garage. So you've got these three levels of where these distortions operate in our experience. So the first of these levels is the level of perception, and that is the easiest to discern, as it were, the easiest to look at, the level of perception. That's our ground floor, that's the level of perception. And then here, that's where we are now, that's the level of thought and emotion. And then in the parking garage below, that's the level of the views. So you can't see it when you're looking outside. You just see this building, but there is stuff happening, yeah, that we're not aware of, that you're not seeing from the outside or from where you're standing. So these are these levels on which these distortions, these vipalasas operate. They're also called vipalasas, actually. And so, yes, and they're more difficult to discern as we go down into the ground, the unknown territory. So on the first, the level is the level of, it's called the Sanya Vipalasa, which is the distortion of perception. So Sanya is just another word for perception. It's a Pali word for perception. And so it's interesting that in terms of how our perception works, that what you're perceiving is already, there's some sort of choice that's happened there. So there is some sort of pre-selection as to what you're actually perceiving. That's sometimes it's about your character. If your character is in a particular way, you walk into a room and you see, you know, if you're a lightning engineer, you start to look at the light, don't you? So that is where your perception goes. If you're somebody, if you're like a cleaner, or you're really interested in cleanliness, then you might see the dust in the corners. You see what I mean? So it's like, how you are, what you're bringing with you, determines what you're actually seeing. Yeah, so that's the, or hearing even. So is that subtle selection process going on? So the perception, a lot of course, what we're perceiving, what we're hearing, there's no denying to it. There is something there. You know, there is something there. You're hearing something, you're seeing something, you're listening to something. But a lot of the perception is not actually happening that in that moment, but you're reconstructing it from memory. So you're reconstructing parts of it from memory. For instance, I found an example in a traditional text today, which is about a scarecrow, for instance. So you suppose you've got a bird, and a bird comes into a garden and he sees this scarecrow, or she, whatever, and they're thinking that might be a human being. It isn't actually a human being, but it's got some vague characteristics of a human being. It's got a hat on, it's got some clothes on, it's got this rough sort of shape and form of a human being. So our perception can often work like that. So you're hearing a sound, and on basis of your memory, for instance, you kind of constructing that perception. So you're imbuing that with, like, from your memory bank, as it were, you're retrieving, okay, you've got bird sounds, okay, that might be like a blackbird, or, you know, you don't really know where it's a blackbird. And when you're in Australia, it could be that other bird, what's that called again? There's a bird in Australia that can imitate all sounds. Yay, that's it, the lyrebird, yeah. So, you know, that's a good example for, like, how perception can completely trick you. So it doesn't necessarily mean there's a blackbird there. There could be somebody with a ringtone of a blackbird there. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? There could be a lyrebird there. So you could make a good guess as to what that is, that perception, but you don't really know what it actually is, if you see what I mean. Because you're reconstructing it from your memory, as it were. And I was thinking earlier tonight about how when I was living in Amsterdam for some time, I was working in a shop selling coffee beans and tea leaves. And sometimes you get these people who said, oh yeah, no, I just gave you 20 euros. And they actually gave you 10 euros, but they tried to trick you into then, you know, giving you more change back. Mm. See what I mean? And that wouldn't be the case, because we had been taught that we needed to stick the bank note in a particular place before we put it into the till. But I was just thinking about it, that is like a trick of perception. It's very easy to make a mistake like that, to see a £10 note as a £20 note, for instance. So it's just very easy to tweak these perceptual moments, as it were. So there is distortion happening on that level of perception. That's what we understand, and in terms of how, so sanya is like a label. So there is a particular experience, okay, or there is a particular. Here I've got the bowl, the metal bowl. So I could say, this is a metal bowl. But the reality of this is just so much more complex than the word bowl or metal bowl even. Because there is a particular metal, I've got no clue what kind of metal it is. It's got a particular size, it's got a particular kind of history, it's got a particular kind of tone. There's all these characteristics of this bowl. I've got actually no clue what it actually is. Do you see what I mean? I just got this label, bowl. And I stick that label bowl on it, very neat, tidy label, bowl. But actually, reality doesn't correspond with that label that I'm giving it. You see what I mean? So in that sense, there's always distortion going on if we're sticking these labels on reality, because reality is constantly shifting and changing. It's so much more rich and interesting than that kind of word that we stick on it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So somehow is sticking that word bowl on an object. It's a bit like there's a symphony of music. You've got all these sounds going on, and you're trying to grab a note. You're trying to grab a note and hold it in your hand. It's impossible in that sense for a concept to describe actual reality, what is really happening. It just can't be covered by a word or a concept. You see what I mean? So it's always actually the moment that you're labelling it, things have already moved on. It's quite frustrating in that respect. It's really frustrating. Okay, so perception is this really curious mix between known elements and unknown elements. So there's definitely a bowl here, you see what I mean? But there's all sorts of unknown elements as well that I'm imbuing, that I'm attributing to it. So that's the kind of distortion that's happening. So that's the level of perception. So there's this distortion happening on the level of perception. You're bringing your own stuff to it. You're bringing your own preferences to it. You're bringing your own selection process to it. What perception there is in the first place is selective. So the level down, so we're going into where we are now, is called the citta vipalasa. And citta, I think a lot of you might know, it's a Buddhist word for heart-mind. In Buddhism, there is no difference between... They don't have that thing like mind is like here, where the head is, and the heart is like lower. It's the heart-mind. There is no separation there. So thought and emotion, they're all in the realm of the citta, as it were, the heart-mind. So this distortion level... the level of citta is happening on that heart, mind, emotional level, and also on the level of thoughts. So I had this memory of, I just tried to get a memory from my memory bank this today as I was thinking about this particular distortion on this particular level. And I was having this memory of... I was babysitting, I think I was about 12 years old, and I was babysitting at the neighbours, like two or three houses down the road, and at some point I just completely lost it. I was completely fearful and had to run home to get my parents, because what I saw was there was this wind, there was a window was open, and there were these two men's shoes, and they were put under the curtain. So the wind was blowing, and I actually thought there was somebody standing in the room behind the curtain, because there were these shoes there, if you see what I mean. So completely from this sort of fabrication of some sort of fear, being on my own, or feeling a bit like out of control with these children, a bit like ill at ease. And then I just completely constructed this body and this person behind the curtain. In fact, when my father turned up, it was just a pair of shoes that was left there, if you see what I mean. So that is the kind of distortion that can happen on that level. You get lots of emotion and thoughts about something, but it isn't actually what is actually happening. Yeah, it's what you attributed to it, what you bring to it, and it's all sorts of stuff that's happened to you, your preferences, all sorts of things that you bring to that level. Yeah, so that's the citta vipalasa. So again, you're starting to create a particular story about something, and it's got nothing to do anymore with what's actually going on. It's this sort of, there is this world of that you hallucinated, that you completely constructed, and there is what's actually going on. Yeah, so that is the level of distortion there, on the citta vipalasa. And then lastly, we've got the ditti vipalasa. So ditti is a Pali word. It's a word for a view. I find it quite interesting, that area of view. So you get that we're now into the parking garage. It's like a really difficult level to perceive, to get hold of. And it's all those views that we have about the world, about how things should be, that are constantly interfering with reality, with our perceptions, with our thoughts, with our emotion. So just suppose that you can have a view about, I should be happy. I mean, seriously, this is like, I've got the right to be happy. So it also means that when you're not happy, you think something is really, really seriously wrong. So, which is actually quite, you know, a life where you're 100% happy all the time. It's like, I don't think that's to be found. So, because there is ups and downs, there's always stuff, there's always difficulties in the world. You're never going to get round not having any difficulties. So having this idea like I shouldn't have any difficulties, there shouldn't be any difficulties, that is like it's a view which is a distorted view of how reality really functions. And there's all sorts of whoa, there's such a huge number of views there that, well, there is this view about how the world should be. If such, for instance, I think I had a few examples that I wrote down. Just as views about the deeply rooted notions about race and about gender, they're all on that kind of level of, there is a distortion of reality going on there that's constantly affecting how you respond to the world and how you view the world. And it's just incredibly difficult to sometimes even see those. I remember that a few years ago, I just noticed myself, I was telling these, I've got quite a complicated family. I've got a really complicated family. But I noticed myself sometime last year or a few years ago, I was telling these stories about my family, this, blah, blah, that. And I just thought, this just sounds really, really hollow, the way I'm talking about this, because they just become these stories. There's just these stories, my mother is this, and I am like that, and my brother is like that. And in reality, again, things are just so much more complex and complicated than that. So you can have these views that this person is such and such, or I am this particular person that is this and that. I'm a person that is cheerful, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's great if you think you're a person that's cheerful, much better than you thinking I'm a person that's depressed, because that's much more unpleasant, isn't it? But both of the occasions are actually illusory, because there's this whole range of fluctuation of emotion and that's going on all the time. So that's the kind of distortions that we're making on the level of views. There's views about ourselves, there's views about other people, there's views about race, there's views about gender, there's views about how the world should be. And they're all distortions, basically, because everything is so incredibly more rich. And it leads to unhappiness, because if somebody then acts out of character, you're getting upset, because they shouldn't be responding like that, because I deserve to be left alone. I deserve to be really quiet. I deserve to have a really quiet space. Like this morning, for instance, I noticed that I was planning to prepare my talk in my front room, and there was all this clanging going on in front of the house, and they were putting some scaffolding up in front of a house. I didn't know anything about that, and I was kind of thinking, what, you know, I'm supposed to prepare my talk, I'm supposed to have this silent kind of space, but it's not like I'm entitled to that. So if you're more fluid with that, you don't get the suffering of that frustration. If you can go more deeply into all of that, you can liberate yourself a bit more from feeling that emotional pain around that things don't turn out the way you expected them to be. So, I had another stereotype or another kind of thing is like, this is the WLB Sangha and everybody's fantastic here. Everybody's completely fantastic. Well, okay. Or you could also think, you could sit here and think, everybody's actually really awful here. I'm never going to come back after tonight. This is just absolutely awful here. Which is both of them. Again, they're just wrong views. Yeah. I find that really interesting. You know, like you're meeting the third person that day that's just horrible to you and is insulting you, when you've met the third person that day, I think that's a sure sign there's something going on in you rather than everybody being out to get you, if you see what I mean. So, I'll just quickly zip to some of these ways that I think that you could use these vipalasas. So, well, you could actually work backwards, which I think is an interesting method. So just suppose there is some sort of, you're experiencing in yourself some sort of emotional pain, but you can't put your finger on what it is, but you know it's not hatred or anger or whatever, it's not kind of greed, but like you don't quite know what it is. You can start to sort of analyze or reflect on, okay, what is it that I'm expecting here? Am I expecting permanence, where there isn't any permanence? Or am I expecting to find pleasure here, and there isn't any pleasure here? You could ask yourself these questions. What is it that actually gets frustrated here? What is it that doesn't get met here, that this arises? And then you can find those distortions of mind there, I think. I mean, I invite you to try it out. Well, so it's quite interesting. Quite interesting to try this out. And also, it's just interesting to see that you're starting to pay attention to what your habits are as far as noticing things is concerned. So that might be really interesting too, because you've got this... Every one of us has got this kind of habitual way of responding, this habitual way of noticing particular things and not noticing other things. So it might be really interesting to spend a day just noticing, like, what is it that I'm actually not paying attention to? What is that about? What is to be found at? It might be really interesting. Might balance things out a bit. Yes, I think I'm just running out of time here, but I just think that if you would use these tools to look into experience or some sort of emotional suffering, mental suffering is arising, and you dig down into it a bit more, you explore it a bit more. Well, one thing is that the type of attention, if you give it your kind attention, it means you get a bit less entangled in the difficulty anyway. You're kind of taking a step back. You're really interested in it, so it also means that you're not going to blame yourself, or there's the negative emotions around it started to weaken somewhat. So you're giving it your wise attention. You can give it your kindness or your compassion. But it could be really interesting to dig down and to drill down into the way that our minds are distorting habitually reality, so we don't really see things as they really are.